Hi, we're done. I'd like to extend our most heartfelt greetings to all of you, and especially to anyone who might, I don't know if there is anyone who's coming for the first time. Everyone's welcome. So first I want to mention that there will be some handouts that we're going to give near the end of the class, because people come late sometimes. So those will be reprints of this past week's material, if anyone still needs, and next week's material, including you've already received a study guide outline for chapter 3, but we revised it a little bit. So that's going to be included in the handout for next week, because we're not studying chapter 3 this week anyway. Today, we're looking at Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2. So, as is customary, we will go through the study guide, which is practically only one page. And this time, I'm going to go through this quickly, and my talk, the intention of my talk will be to take us what's underneath. You see, this is like the overview, and also Maharaj spoke quite a bit on the second canon himself by going over the answers, the specific answers to the questions, which are not second canon, second chapter. The six questions in the first canto, four or five, are answered in the second canto. So Maharaj went over that. So I'm going to go further than that, deeper than that. So, starting from the top, 2.0, Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 2, Hisatu Goswami's answer to the first four foundational questions. The specific verses that apply to specific questions are noted before.
I think this should be 1.5 instead of 2.5.
Yeah, it should be 1.5 instead of 2.5. That's a typographical error. Still, chapter 2 as a whole is to be understood as Sutta's general answer to the six questions, or at least most of the six questions. So, 2.1, chapter 2, divinity and divine service versus summary. This is the storyline, so to speak. So, before replying, Sutta Goswami first offers his obeisances to his guru, Sri Sukadeva Goswami, Lord Narayan, the sages Nara Narayan Rishi, Mother Saraswati, and Srila Vyasadeva. This is the summary of verses 1 through 4. Sutta praises the sages' inquiries, for they are about Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He stresses the importance of the process of self-realization and its goal, devotional service to Krishna. That's the summary of verses 5 through 10. Sutta says further that since Krishna is the absolute truth, one must satisfy him by devotional service, verses 11 through 15 summarized here. He describes the gradual progress of consciousness of a devotee who overcomes the effects of the modes of nature and attains pure devotional service through the proper hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam and serving pure devotees. Summary of verses 16 through 22. Sutta explains Lord Krishna's position as beyond the modes of nature. Those who are serious about liberation worship only him, for the Lord is the supreme goal of life. Summary of verses 23 through 29. The chapter ends with Sutta's description of how the Lord, although transcendental to the material world, first creates the material world and then maintains his creation. Summary of verses 30 through 34. And then 2.2 is a summary of, philosophical summary, of this chapter, taken from one Bhaktivedanta purport. Therefore it's marked BVP, and this is the purport to verse 8. And I would like you to listen to this because this is very deep and sweet, coming directly from His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The need of the spirit soul is that he wants to get out of the limited sphere of material bondage and fulfill his desire for complete freedom. He wants to get out of the covered walls of the greater universe. He wants to see the free light and the spirit. That complete freedom is achieved when he meets the complete spirit, the personality of Godhead. There is a dormant affection for God within everyone. Spiritual existence is manifested through the gross body and mind in the form of perverted affection for gross and subtle matter. Therefore, we have to engage ourselves in occupational engagements that will evoke our divine consciousness. This is possible only by hearing and chanting the divine activities of the Supreme Lord. And any occupational activity which does not help one to achieve attachment for hearing and chanting the transcendental message of Godhead is said herein to be simply a waste of time. This is because other occupational duties, whatever ism they may belong to, cannot give liberation to the soul. Even the activities of the salvationists are considered to be useless because of their failure to pick up the fountainhead of all liberties. The gross materialist can practically see that his material gain is limited only to time and space, either in this world or in the other. Even if he goes up to the Svargaloka, he will find no permanent abode for his hankering soul. The hankering soul must be satisfied by the perfect scientific process of perfect devotional service. So, now as I said, we want to look at this chapter a bit more under the magnifying glass. So, I want to start with the invocation to chapter 4, which is found beginning with text 2 and through text 4. So already in chapter 1, we read of a saintly devotee sage named Sukadev Goswami, to whom Srila Vyasadev, the author of this great literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, offered respects in verse 3 of chapter 1. So, who is this Sukadev? We only hear the name and we see the actual author is offering respects to him. So, Sukha, which means parrot, is praised by Vyas for having sweetened the nectar of the Bhagavatam by the touch of his lotus lips when he recited it. And this is about all we learn from the verses of Canto 1 of Sukadev Goswami. So, in the invocation to chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, out of the total invocation, verses 2 through 4, Sukadev Goswami reveals that Sukha spontaneously took sannyas and left home even before accepting the sacred thread from his father, who happened to be the great sage Srila Vyasadev, the author of the work. So this is remarkable. We find out that this Sukadev Goswami, whom the author Vyasadeva is offering his respects to, is the father of Sukadev Goswami. So remarkable. In fact, Sukadev Goswami participated in none of the rituals that are normally performed by the higher castes of Varnashram society. Yet Sukha is described in this invocation of chapter 2 as the spiritual master of all sages, including Srila Vyasadeva. It was he who spoke the kernel of Vedic knowledge due to his compassion for those struggling to cross the ocean of material existence. So this description of Sukadev Goswami, as you know, we'll hear later, but this is just, as they say, a trailer or coming attractions. Sukadev Goswami, he, by his own volition, remained 16 years within the womb of his mother because he was a completely realized Brahmavari, who thought, what's the use of taking birth? Might as well just stay in here where I'm being taken care of and engage in no karmic activities at all. He saw no reason to engage his senses in sense objects or think of anything, have to think of anything except absorption in the Brahman. So, but then he was born because he heard the nectarian verses of the Bhagavatam being spoken from outside, and immediately he just left the ashram, the home of his father, and entered the forest. And his second canto so poetically states, the trees of the forest simply resounded, echoed with the sound of Vyasadeva calling, oh my son, where have you gone? As he strode off, totally naked, without clothing, for hundreds and hundreds of miles, and Krishna led him to the bank of the Ganga to meet Maharaj Parikshit at his coming attraction for what we will meet with at the end of this canto. So this situation of Shukadeva Goswami walking off as a fully realized soul before accepting any Vedic reformatory ritual, not even taking Vedic thread. What famous verse from early in chapter 1 of Canto 1 does this remind us of? Anyone care to take a guess? Or anyone who is full of transcendental knowledge care not to guess but to just tell us?
Yes. I think about that when Krishna goes back to the spiritual world and Bhagavatam takes over the position of the religious activities.
As they say, close but no cigar. Anyone else? Alright. So, the verse is Dharmaha Projita Kaitavo Atra Paramo Matsaranam Satam Vedyam Vastavam Atra Vastu Shivram Tapat Chalmulanam Srimad Bhagavate Mahamunikrite Kim Vapara Ishvara Sadyohari Avrujyate Trakritibi Shushabish Takshanat, which means completely rejecting all religious activities which are materially motivated, including even this, at least in ordinary Varnashram culture. This Bhagavat Purana propounds the highest truth, which is understandable by those devotees who are fully pure in heart. So what does that say about Shukadeva Goswami? From the very beginning of his life, he was completely pure in heart. That is Prabhupada's translation of Nirmat Saranam Shatam. Satam, of course, means devotee. Nirmat Saranam means literally in Sanskrit, Panditji?
Free of envy.
Yes. Free of envy. That is what it means to be pure in heart. And that is very important. And that's what I mean. That's your first insight into what I mean by looking behind. Looking what's behind this second canto. The highest truth is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Such truth uproots the threefold miseries. This beautiful Bhagavatam compiled by the great sage Vyasadeva in his maturity, compiled, but not originally spoken by in its sweetest form, is sufficient in itself for God realization, because that's why Vyasadeva praises his son Sukadeva Goswami, because he says, even though I compiled it, my son Sukadeva made it sweeter by his recitation, because of his being Nirmat Saranam Satam, a pure devotee of the Lord. What is the need for any other scripture? Revolutionary statement. And I'll tell you, in the Bhagavata, which I'll be citing from, this is the English book on the Srimad Bhagavatam that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote. I'll be citing quite a lot from that in my presentation. He gives this fantastic analogy of when when the Muslims entered. Could I have a pot of water or something, please? One of you boys could just quickly run with Marsha with water. There's this fantastic image he gives us from history of when the Muslims, the newly converted, fired-up Muslims, just streaming out of Arabia, they began to conquer the whole Middle East, and they entered Egypt. And they came to Alexandria, and in Alexandria there was a tremendous library containing literally millions of books. We can't imagine, this was, you know, so many hundreds of years ago, what books must have been in that library that had been there since the time of the pharaohs, since the time of ancient Greece, that whole part of the world. There was also Vedic knowledge in that area. Tons and tons, millions and millions of volumes. And the general of the Muslim army, he said, whatever in this library agrees with the Holy Quran, therefore does not need to exist on its own because we already have the Quran, and whatever disagrees should not exist because it is simply blasphemy. So set the whole damn thing on fire. And the Muslims did that, and the library burnt for 3 days. There were so many books in it. So His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, actually gives that vision regarding the Vedic literatures compared to the Srimad Bhagavatam. So keep that in mind. Where is the need for any other scripture? As soon as one attentively and submissively hears the message of Bhagavatam, by this culture of knowledge of the Supreme Lord is established within his heart. So, some important words from this verse. Dharma, prodhita kaitava dharma. That means to completely reject the dharma, the religiosity, which is kaitava. In Srila Prabhupada's word for word, he translates that as covered by fruitive intention. So, someone who has done that, who has rejected kaitava dharma, what does such a person seek? What is there left for him to seek? Paramaha, says the verse, which Prabhupada translates as the highest or ultimate truth. But then, among those who may reject the kaitava dharma, including the fully blown karmic version of, or karma jnana version of Vedic culture, which still consists of very elevated personalities coming from pure gotras that can be traced all the way back to Lord Brahma. So we know that, as Maharaj mentioned yesterday, there are certain descendants of Kasyapa who also completely rejected that dharma. And we happen to be descended from them. And our forefathers are hardly deserving of the adjective glorious. So, who is qualified? In other words, the thing that you reject the kaitava dharma for is parama, the ultimate truth. But then the question comes, who is qualified to seek and find this truth? So as already mentioned, nimatsaranam satam. The devotees who are free of envy, of all envy. So what truth do such devotees find that others cannot? Vastu, that is made vedyam. Now what does the word vastu mean? I'm interested to hear your answer. What does the word vastu mean?
Continence of form. Continence of form. The essence of the form.
The essence of the form. Now that is good. I'll give you a cigarillo for that answer. Because you've answered the question like touching your nose like this. substance of the contents of the form means substance. That's actually what vastu means. I asked this question because I was expecting someone to raise their hands. Well, that means a science of how to position different auspicious places in different location, different auspicious things in different locations to get all auspiciousness. That is a secondary answer, but the primary answer is that the word vastu means substance, means primal substance. As they say, would say in Western philosophy, the ground of being itself. So vastu that is made vedyam, that is made knowable, vastu that you can know. Now the thing is, there are so many philosophies that claim to be making knowable the vastu, the ground of being, the ultimate substance or ultimate reality. So therefore Bhagavatam adds, not only vedyam, but vastavam, which means you are in direct contact with it. Just like I see our little Narahari here. Now he's sitting before me, but he might be an illusion. Maharaj might have set up some kind of, as a, you know, very exotic hologram system and be simply creating a three-dimensional image of little Narahari. So I know him, you know, I know that's Narahari, but his substance is not there. But if I reach out and touch him and feel his substance, then I know he's really there. So Bhagavatam is saying, in that way, we may know the vastu. If we go through this process of Bhagavad Dharma, the Dharma taught by Srimad Bhagavatam. So, now, I'm going to talk about the question of vasu. It is termed in Western philosophy as the first principle or the first principles. This is a technical, philosophical... Someone up there is talking quite loudly. I wish they wouldn't do that. The first principle. This is a technical term from philosophy. So, to belong to any philosophy, in other words, if you call yourself a Marxist, if anyone is proudly calling himself a Marxist, what does that mean? It means that there are fundamental so-called truths taught by Karl Marx that you must accept. Otherwise, you cannot be a Marxist. If you run around with a red flag, hammer and sickle and tiger on it, and wave it, and you say, and you shout, I'm for free market capitalism! I'm for opening up the stock market! I'm for free trade between natures and nations with no taxation, no import tax! I'm not a Marxist. You may have the flag, but what you're saying is not Marxist philosophy. So you must accept the first principles of any philosophy. And it's important to note, and this is admitted by Western philosophers, and this is certainly true as far as Vedic philosophy goes, that first principles are not based on universal, self-evident perception or logic. In other words, the first principle is not something that we are directly in touch with, that we can just see like that, or we just all understand like that. You see, we just all pop out of the room and, oh yeah, hi Mom, hi Dad, yeah, I know your name is Sam and your name is Josephine, and here we are at 142 North Rose Street in Upper Wabash, and etc. So, you know, we have all knowledge of it. That's not how knowledge comes to us. Even ordinary knowledge takes a great effort to learn. So first principles are beyond ordinary knowledge, you see. And they are, this is important, in philosophy, they're always established by a person. And I'm not talking about Vedic philosophy only, I'm talking about all philosophy. For instance, just two quick examples. One example from a recent science. The truth according to Guth. Who's Guth? He's a physicist named Alan Guth, who's conceived of this fantastic theory that this universe is just one bubble-like sphere in a vast ocean of bubbles. Wow! What a new idea! Something we've never heard before! Fantastic! And Professor Alan Guth has worked it out mathematically that this is the most logically consistent conception of our universe. And because other, envious, because that's the whole problem here, other physicist sages who are not Nimatsaranam, they're not so quick to accept this theory, so they say, oh yes, that's the truth according to Guth. But you see, the theory comes from this person, Alan Guth. It exists on the strength of his fame and glory as being a great physicist. Otherwise, who would care if, you know, some newspaper bala on the street is shouting, the universe is a bubble, and it's one among many millions of bubbles. Who would care? You see, if the shoeshine boy is shouting this out, who, everyone's walking by, shut up. Stop making noise. So, and then Nietzsche's God is dead. You know, that became a big issue in the theologies of the 1960s. I remember that I was a young boy coming into my teens in the 1960s, so I began to become aware of issues, and that was one issue. I clearly remember when you'd hear it on the radio and TV that certain Protestant theologians were declaring God is dead. But this goes back to a German philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche, who, by the way, spent the last 10 years of his life in an insane asylum. So he proclaimed God is dead. He was the first Western philosopher so bold as to just openly shout from the rooftops, God is dead. Everyone before him was, God is good. But he, God is dead! Like Ramanujacharya shouting, Om Lord Bhagavate Vasudevaya from the rooftops. Everyone chant this mantra. So he made no bones about it. God is dead. So there's a funny cartoon. You see Nietzsche with his beard, and he had these funny glasses he would wear in the first box, and there's the voice balloon, you know, that they have in those comics. And he's, God is dead! And then the next one, you see a gravestone, Friedrich Nietzsche, R.I.P., which in English, on English gravestones, that stands for rest in peace, so he's buried. And then there's a voice balloon from the sky, Nietzsche is dead, coming from God. So, if you're a Nietzschean, because it just so happened in the University of Amsterdam, a couple of years ago, I actually had a kind of debate or discussion, public debate discussion, with a Nietzschean philosopher. So this gentleman, he was a devotee of Friedrich Nietzsche. He was just quoting Nietzsche, chapter and verse, chapter and verse, chapter and verse. And when I would raise something, he would answer from Nietzsche. He was totally sold out to Nietzsche. So that's what it actually means to practice philosophy, even in the West. Ultimately, you're following some great personality, some so-called great personality, some founder-acharya, some avatar, whatever, in the word of ignorance.
In Sanskrit, it means fallen Nietzsche.
Huh?
In Sanskrit, it means fallen.
Oh, Nietzsche. Very good. And he surely was. Although there's one interesting thing. Just before he went mad, this is a true story. I think I even heard it from this person I was debating. This is fine, interesting. Just before he went mad, the last thing he did was, he was walking down the street and he saw a man beating a horse. There was a horse that was pulling his personal carriage. And the man was whipping the horse again and again. Nietzsche began to cry and embraced the horse. And he was saying, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I beg your forgiveness, poor animal, for what we humans are doing to your kind. And after that he went mad. So he had some kind of, must have had some kind of realization in his last moments of sanity that totally contradicted all the books, atheistic books, books of the Superman, will to power, acting without any guilt, doing what is necessary. He must have had some kind of realization, sentimental at least in the heart, that drove him mad, literally, because he realized everything he'd written before was just craziness. So anyway, enough about the fallen one. When it comes to the question of Vastu, all philosophies in the world can be divided into two positions. Who can tell me what those two positions are? Now, I want to hear from our young students. Because if you don't know this, I'm going to start really wondering what is being taught in this gurukul. So now Maharaj is on the spot, you've got to save him. There are only two types of philosophy over the whole world, including even philosophy of India. What are they?
Krishna conscious and non-Krishna
conscious. Well, I'll give you an honorary cigar for that, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. There's specific Sanskrit terms. Specific Sanskrit terms. Okay, you've really let me down. Astika and Nastika. So what does asti mean? Come on.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yes or there is? There is. There is what? There is Vastu. There is an ultimate principle, an ultimate truth, an ultimate reality, something that is real. There is. And what does nasti mean?
There is not.
There is not. So, these are the two ultimate divisions all over the world of philosophy. So, even the side that accepts Vastu, the astikas, they differ as to exactly what that Vastu is. In other words, they do not achieve Vastavam, direct contact with Vastu. They hover on the mental plane and are always troubled by doubts. Now remember how the Bhagavatam starts? With six questions that lays the foundation of the whole book. And where do questions come from, pray tell? Can anyone tell me?
Doubts.
So this is what I mean by going behind the scenes. The six questions, and this is a hint. Listen closely to what I say here, because at the end of the class you'll find out. The six questions are asked by sages who themselves were pure devotees. Yet, their questions represent fundamental doubts that are rampant among ordinary humanities, or even great philosophers, and even great scholars of Vedic knowledge. We will examine the doubts these questions represent. We will learn from chapter 2 how these doubts are removed. So by a close study of chapter 2, we learn about the doubts, and we learn about how to remove them. And to do this, actually all we need to do is study three, I'm only going to look at three of the six questions that will cover everything. So, moving on. In a book that he originally wrote, I have to take a drink here, my key is going down. Maybe only Murari knows what that means. Qi in Chinese is qi, and qi in Sanskrit is prana. And the sign that your prana is going down is when the mouth goes dry. So, and prana means life here. So it means I'm losing my strength, and soon I'll be asleep here. And you wouldn't like that, so therefore I'm drinking water. So, so in a book he originally wrote in the English language, titled The Bhagavat, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says about the Srimad Bhagavatam, now I have to say that because Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote this book in the 19th century Victorian, English, I have taken a few liberties to simplify his language. Otherwise, I think a lot of us, or some of us here, will be curing our insomnia as we start reading some of these longer sections of quotations from that book. So, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that the seeker, remember, the seeker, he who rejects society and goes seeking the truth, the seeker must believe that all that he calls nature, nature is vastu, nature is substance, is created by God and is therefore full of spiritual essence and relations. Notice that. Nature is really full of spiritual essence. Yes. So spiritual essence could mean Brahman. But then he adds and relations, so it does not mean impersonal Brahman. But this seeker must not believe that the outward appearance of this nature is the truth. The Bhagavad Gita teaches that all that we healthily perceive, when you are in a healthy state of consciousness, when your senses are actually in their healthy original state, that means spiritually healthy. When your mind is in its healthy original state, it means spiritually healthy. When your intelligence is spiritually healthy. When your soul is shining in full spiritual health. Bhagavad Gita teaches that when we healthily perceive that all that we healthily perceive is true, but its material appearance is transient and illusory. The scandal of the Gnostica theory consists in its tendency to falsify nature. What is the Mayavadi slogan? Come on, you've got to know this. Please. The famous Mayavadi slogan in Sanskrit.
Brahma Satya
Jagat. Yes. Brahma Satya. The Brahman is truth. The Jagat, the universe, is mithya or false. So Srila Bhaktivinoda calls that motto a scandal. It's because it's the tendency to falsify nature. But the Bhagavad explains that nature is true, if not as eternally true as God Himself. No, understanding this is not merely a matter of changing a name. What does that mean? So, there's a note here from me. This is all that mundane philosophers do, is they argue about terminology or names. They just give names to things, including their conceptions of first principles, fancy, 50-letter words, and they argue about them. So therefore, Prabhupada calls this world of Maya, what does he call it? The world of names and forms, that's all. We see some forms, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, these outward forms, we must understand they're illusions, so these illusory forms, we give them names, and then we spend all day and night arguing over nothing but empty words. So, a change, Bhaktivinoda Thakur goes on to say, a change of our own human nature is required. Nature is eternally spiritual, but the intervention of Maya makes her gross and material. The Bhagavata, the Srimad Bhagavatam, teaches us this relation between man, nature or vastu, and God. And we must all attain this knowledge. So the very first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam states in part, and I won't bother asking any more questions, Muyanti yat surya tejo varim mudam yata vinaya mayo yatra trisago musha. This is a famous phrase taken out of 111, Srimad Bhagavatam. What does it mean? By him, by the Lord. Even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representation of water seen in fire or land seen on water, Only because of him do the material universes temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of material nature appear factual, although they are real. So therefore, daivihiyesha gunamayi mama maya duratiya. There is simply no way for a jiva soul, no matter how ritualistically and academically qualified he may be, even in the Vedic sense, to get free of Maya's powerful hold, except who?
One who surrenders to Krishna.
Yes, one who surrenders to Krishna. I remember hearing a lecture in which Srila Prabhupada said, Maya Devi is God's Shakti, which means God's power. Which means she has all of Krishna's power at her disposal. The entirety, he was saying this in the election, that the entirety of Krishna's power is handed over to Durga Devi to keep us in illusion. Fortunately, she is the most humble servant of the Lord. She's a bhaktin, and therefore the Lord trusts her with that power. But she is powerful. And that's why she gets so much worship here in Bengal. She's so powerful. But her power is the power to keep us in illusion. Therefore, we should not worship her. So every living entity in the material world is under the control of the Lord's Maya and therefore cannot perceive the truth behind her external illusory appearance. Now, is this going on because Krishna doesn't like us? Is that it? Krishna took a look at us particular jivas, and said, I don't like you. My Devi, stick him with your trishul. You know, that means the tapatraya, the threefold miseries. Just give him a good jab with it. I don't like this bun. Get him out of here. Stick him on your trishul and carry him out. No, this is not the answer to the question. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura writes in the Bhagavata, listen to this, it's very short, like a sutra. Party spirit, that great enemy of truth, will always baffle the attempt of the inquirer. You know, Srila Prabhupada said, the whole purpose of the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna is teaching us to break our attachment to what he called our own men. In other words, our own party, our own so-called group, grouping under the modes of nature. This family, this nation, this race, this religion, you know, this group of people with this size of nose or this size of nose or ears that stick out, or my particular group, the sinistras who are left-handed. You know, the English word sinister, you know what that means? Someone you can't trust, comes from the Latin sinistra, which means left. So left-handed people are sinister. So there are us, the sinister group, you see. So, Prabhupada once said that the whole point of Bhagavad Gita is Krishna is teaching us to break away from our party, our grouping under the modes of material nature. As Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati writes in a Brahma Samhita purport, quote, nature embodying the accommodating principle, adhara is maya. So adhara means the accommodating principle. In other words, what you want, you want? Huh? You want to be Ukrainian? Poof! Maya Devi says, alright, so now you're Ukrainian. Enjoy yourself. You see, you want to be Bengali? Poof! Enjoy being a Bengali. You know, you want to be South American? Poof! Enjoy that. So it's our desire that is a leading factor. And the Adhara Shakti is accommodating that. And this Adhara is included in Srimati Radharani, one of the Goswami Granthas. It is said, 1/1,000,000th part of Srimati Radharani's total potency is that Maya Shakti. Adhara is included within Radharani. Ra Adharani. It's even included in your name. So, hence, the association with Matsaram Satam non-envious, pure-hearted devotees is absolutely necessary because they have no selfish desires and allegiances to warring parties of thought. She, Srimati Radharani, the spiritual potency, the original Bhakti Devi, reveals her true nature to them. By her grace, one may experience Vastavam, the truth of the relationship between the Lord, His energy, Radharani, the Adya Shakti, the original potency, and the Jiva. Therefore, in Srimad Bhagavatam 1-21, this chapter, chapter 2, verse 21, Vidyate Hridaya Grantis Chidyante Sarva Shamsayaha. Shamsayaha, what does it mean? Doubts. Thus, the knot in the heart is pierced and all doubts are cut to pieces. So we each have a hridaya granta, a hard knot, a what? Attachment. Attachment to being not Krishna Das, but trying to be Krishna ourselves. Krishna Adas, Ishwara. We have a strong attachment to be the Ishwara, which means the master of the potency. The master of Maya. Each one of us wants to be Maya's master. And she's so much powerful than us. So, therefore, poof, you're Ukrainian. Poof, you're South American. Poof, you're North American. That's what we're getting as a result. So, when a hard knot of attachment is cut, then all doubts are also cut to pieces. So in other words, doubts represent our attachments or the impurities of our hearts. That's what they are. Just like there are sunspots, you know, spots on the sun. So the soul, the spirit soul, is often is in Bhagavad Gita 13th chapter compared to the sun. But there are spots on the sun-like soul. Spots of dirty things, and they radiate up into the mind, into the brain, as things we don't understand, things we can't grasp, things that even after we've heard 1,000 times in class, like there are two types of philosophy, asti, nasti, we still can't remember, we still don't get it, you see, because the heart remains impure. And that's when the chain of fruitive actions is terminated, when one sees the self as master. This verse is talking about seeing the Atma, the soul, as the master. Now, before someone goes, aha, I knew it. I knew that Mayavadi philosophy was true. I refer you to Srimad Bhagavatam 11.20.30, which is practically the same verse except for the last line. Vidyate hridaya grantis chidyante sarvasamsaya chidyante chashakarmani mayidrishte hiratmani. Not in the heart is pierced, and all misgivings, which is a synonym for doubts, are cut to pieces, and the chain of fruitive actions is terminated when I am seen as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This verse is being spoken by Lord Krishna in the Uddhava Gita. So, there goes your Mayavadi philosophy out the window, because it is both the soul and the super soul who are intended to cooperate together. Just like Krishna and Arjuna on the chariot. They were both masters on that chariot. Krishna was Arjuna's spiritual master, and Arjuna was a master bowman on the field of battle under Krishna's instruction. So, someone may ask, and I will warn you right now, I'm sorry, I'm such a stage hogger. I'm not going to be able to finish this today. We're going to have to stop. So I'll just cover the next point, because then we have to go on to other things before 9 o'clock. So, point number 4, it won't take too long to get through. And this is where we end on today's class. Where lies the party spirit in the hearts and minds of great Vedic sages who are cultured who are seemingly non-envious transcendentalists, and yet still hold to doctrines that conflict with one another, like the Sadarshan, the six systems of philosophy. They're clearly in conflict with one another. And we can bring up subdivisions of these. There are many, many conflicting philosophies, even under the Vedic manner. So, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Bhagavat, he gives us an answer. All theologists, please listen. All theologists agree in maintaining that there is only one God without a second, but they disagree in giving a name to that God owing to the different modes of worship which they adopt according to the constitution of their mind. Some call him by the name of Brahma, some by the name of Paramatma, and others by the name of Bhagavan. Those who worship God as infinitely great in the principle of admiration call him by the name of Brahman. This mode is called jnana, or knowledge. So this constitutes that type of Vedic sage who is known as jnana. Yes. Those who worship God as the universal soul in the principle of spiritual union with him give him the name of Paramatma. This is yoga, the yogis. Those who worship God as all in all, with all their heart, body and strength, style him as Bhagavan. This last principle is bhakti. The book that prescribes the relation and worship of Bhagavan procures for itself the name of Bhagavata, or in other words, Srimad Bhagavatam. And the worshipper is also called by that same name. The devotees are called the Bhagavatas. Such is Bhagavata, which is decidedly the book for all classes of theists. If we worship God spiritually as all in all, with all our heart, mind, and body and strength, we are all Bhagavatas, and we lead a life of spiritualism, which neither the worshippers of Brahman nor the yogi uniting his soul with Paramatma, the universal soul, can obtain. So you know in that famous verse, Vedanti Yattattva Vidam, that verse, it is explained that there is one truth, Advayam, which is known as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And Krishna Stu Bhagavan Svayam. Krishna is that original Bhagavan, and he is the cause of all causes. So he is the ultimate truth, and that is the subject matter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the highest conception of the Absolute Truth, which even great sages among the jnanis and karmis fall short of. And therefore, even though they are considered holy and saintly, they are in differentiation from the ultimate Absolute Truth. Srila Prabhupada elaborates on this in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 3.131. This is very important, and this is where we end. But this is very important, so please listen. The empiric philosophers enjoy a transcendental quality of bliss. See, Prabhupada admits that. By philosophical speculation on the Supreme Truth. But beyond that pleasure is the pleasure enjoyed by Brahman in his eternal form of the personality of Godhead. In other words, there is an enjoyment that is experienced by a jiva who may liberate himself by jnana or yoga. He may attain a type of liberation by jnana and yoga, and he's called Atmarami, the Atmarama, but there is the enjoyment of the Lord himself, which is higher, which is supreme. So, Brahman bliss is enjoyed by living entities after liberation from material bondage. But Parabrahman, the personality of Godhead, enjoys eternally a bliss of his own potency, which is called the Hladini potency. And who personifies the Hladini potency? Srimati Radharani. The empiric philosopher who studies Brahman by negation of the external features has not yet learned the quality of the Hladini potency of Brahman. out of many potencies of the omnipotent, there are three features of his internal potency, namely samvit, sandini, and ladini. And in spite of their strict adherence to the principles of yam, niyam, asana, dhyana, dharana, and pranayam, the great yogis and jnanis are unable to enter into the internal potency of the Lord. This internal potency is, however, easily realized by the devotees of the Lord by dint of devotional service. So again, therefore, daivi hiyesha guna mayi mama maya duratyaya mameva ye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. So, my maya, which is originally is Srimati Radharani Prabhupada said, this ma maya is simply either you can understand the tape as a phase or a face, either way it's correct, of the internal potency, yoga maya. Maha maya is a phase or face of yoga maya. And my Maha Maya is very difficult to overcome except for those who have surrendered to me. Thus, by the grace of the internal potency, they can easily cross beyond the external potency. So, here we stop. I beg forgiveness to Maharaj because I'm going to have to continue on Monday. And Monday I'll be starting with the questions. Analyzing the questions, just three of the six, from the point of view of what doubts lurk behind them, and then the process of how these doubts are to be removed. So, now we have to move on. We have to move on to what? We have to move on. Of course, there are handouts to be given out, but even before that, please give me all your attention. Because I have to give you the essay question that you have to write upon. And unfortunately, because I only finished composing this question literally at about 3:30 this morning, after staying up the whole night to prepare for this class, there's only one copy. And the night before, or the morning before this morning, I got up at 1:15. So if I seemed a little spaced out in the class, well, that's why. So in any case, here's the question. Now, I have to read something from Srila Prabhupada. This is from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, verse 18-12, which states, leave out the Sanskrit, the verses. This is spoken by the sages of Naimisharanya. We have just begun the performance of this furtive activity, a sacrificial fire, without certainty of its result. Due to the many imperfections in our action, our bodies have become black from the smoke. But we are effectually pleased by the nectar of the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead Govinda, which you, Sutta Goswami, are distributing. And in his purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada remarks, sacrificial fire kindled by the sages of Naimisharanya was certainly full of smoke and doubts because of so many flaws. The first flaw is that there's an acute scarcity of expert brahmanas able to carry out such performances successfully in this age of Kali. Any discrepancy in such sacrifices spoils the whole show, and the result is uncertain, like agricultural enterprises, etc., etc., etc. And then he says, he speaks of unscrupulous, greedy brahmanas of the age of Kali, who induce the innocent public to such uncertain sacrifices, without disclosing the scriptural injunction that in this age of Kali there is no fruitful sacrificial performance, but the sacrifice of the congregational chanting of the holy name. A little bit later in the same purport, His Divine Grace adds, the sages of Naimisharanya, are you listening carefully? Because this is the question you have to answer. You have to write on today, boys, or over the weekend, boys. If you're not listening, you're going to miss out. You're going to fail the class, because this is all you have to do, is write this paper. And if you can't do that, you get a what we call a goose egg, a zip, A zero? The sage of Naim Shirani practically suffers from the smoke of a sacrificial fire and were doubtful about the result, but by hearing from by a realized person like Suta Goswami, they were fully satisfied. In Brahma Vaigarta Purana, Vishnu tells Shiva that in the age of Kali, men full of anxieties of various kinds can vainly labor in fruitive activities and philosophical speculations, but when they are engaged in devotional service, the result is sure and certain, and there is no loss of energy. In other words, nothing performed for spiritual realization or for material benefit can be successful without the devotional service to the Lord. So, that was by way of preface, and the question is it possible? Is it possible the sages of Naimisharanya were basically ordinary ritualistic priests who, while trying to perform a mundane ceremony, had the unexpected good fortune of Gyapta Sukriti, of hearing a pure devotee recite the Bhagavatam? Could it have been that the satisfaction they felt when they heard about Krishna was mainly born out of their frustration with the failure of their own efforts? And then my note is, after all, it seems that in our time a good number of persons joined ISKCON only after they failed in their own professional pursuits. So I want you to answer that question. Do you think this could be true? Did you all understand the question?
No.
You didn't? Well, you don't even speak English, so I don't see how I can reach. Balaram can translate this for you. After the class, Balaram can translate this for you. But those who speak reasonably good English, did you understand the question? Do I have to say it again? Okay, could it be that the sages of Naimisharanya, who asked these six questions, they were just ordinary, Purohit priests or Yajna Brahmanas who were performing a mundane sacrificial ceremony in the forest and having all kinds of trouble getting their bodies black with smoke and were coughing and were, under their breath, muttering incantations which were not Vedic mantras but certain Shudra sayings that are popularly heard today that we cannot repeat, that are often composed of four letters. And suddenly here comes Suta Goswami, and what a relief! Now we don't have to continue getting burned by fire and smoked up. We can sit and hear him, and at least we'll hear some nice stories if we can't do anything else today. And that gives us some relief from our anxiety. Could that be the case with these sages? So, did you understand that?
Yes.
Okay. So, please provide scriptural evidence and an argument of your own logic to support your answer. Sorry, merely writing, yes, it is possible, and pointing to the quotation that I just quoted will not be accepted. Your yes or no should be based on evidence you find on your own. Only references from Srila Prabhupada's books, please. But kindly do not hand in on Monday a page of paper with his words filling one side. In mentioning a verse, you need only to refer to it by writing out the book title, mentioning the chapter number, and the verse number. If you refer to something from a purport or book of mostly English texts like Nectar Devotion, then mention the title and chapter number and quote only essential phrases from His Divine Grace. Your paper must offer Shastric evidence, but your one page of writing should mainly present an argument that you composed yourself. So I told you this class would be very easy. All right, now we have handouts for you. For those who are not frightened off totally by today's class, you will take registration forms. You'll take those, you'll take them home, you'll fill them out over the weekend, you'll bring them back with 100 rupees. That is what you will do. I command you. And we have also the summary of the verses that we hope we can study next week, including the revision of chapter 3, which we have not covered. And anything else?
And so For those who got pages without the
correcting. All right, those who still did not get our original corrected version of the first two chapters, we have that too. So you have to let him know you're handing out. You should come forward. Please come forward. Please come forward and get from Kashi Mishra.
Also, they can say if they would like to take a full course.
Yeah. Make clear to him if you want to be a full-time student who's reading the books along with the study guide, or you want to be a halfway student.
You can put that on the form.
Is that on the form?
No.
It's not on the form. All right, he has to note it down. But you could put it on the form also. That would make things best. And when you fill out the form, you write it clearly. I consider myself only a halfway committed student who wants to hear the class and to do the paper, do the essay on the weekend, but not have to read the Bhagavatam and not have to take the examinations. Okay? Or I'm a full-time student who does all that. And if you're just an auditor, just here to listen and do nothing more, then don't come forward. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srimad Bhagavatam.